Welcome to the debate. Today we are dissecting a document that claims to be nothing less than a structural MRI of modern civilization. We're looking at the white paper titled The Grammar of Violence: Structural Drivers of Systemic Harm and Pathways to Viability. It was published just this month, February 2026.
Yeah, and notably, it is co-authored by Dr. Bichara Saheli and ChatGPT 5.2. It is a fascinating, if, you know, slightly terrifying read. It attempts to unify stock market crashes, ecological collapse, and geopolitical war under a single theoretical framework.
Which I imagine sets off your skepticism radar immediately.
Oh, absolutely. As always, whenever I see a theory of everything applied to the messy, unpredictable reality of human politics and economics, I get wary.
I understand that skepticism. I really do. But the central question this paper poses is one we simply can't afford to ignore given the state of the world right now. The question is this: are the crises we face, climate breakdown, financial instability, widening inequality, are they just random, unrelated strokes of bad luck? Or are they the mathematically inevitable outputs of a hidden structural grammar, a ruling value code, as they call it, that we've programmed into the very operating system of our institutions?
Right. That is the core diagnosis. The paper argues we are running a background program that makes violence inevitable. I'm here to represent the view that while this structural analysis is intellectually seductive, it risks becoming a totalizing theory. By trying to explain every single aspect of human suffering through one grammar, we overlook the nuance, the progress we've actually made, and the utility of the systems we currently have.
And I am here to argue that the paper correctly identifies a self-sealing architecture of harm. My position is that unless we rewrite this underlying value code, the axiomatic logic of our society, then crisis isn't just a risk, it is a mathematical certainty. The paper argues we are treating symptoms of a disease we refuse to name. So let's look at the diagnosis.
Let's get into it.
The paper begins by tackling structural blindness. It utilizes Johann Galtung's famous violence triangle. Now, most of our listeners will know Galtung, but the application here is very specific. The paper argues that as a society, we are entirely obsessed with direct violence.
The visible tip of the iceberg.
Exactly. The wars, the riots, the police actions, physical assaults. This is what makes the news, right? This is what we legislate against. But the paper argues we are functionally blind to the two massive layers beneath it that actually generate that visible violence.
These being structural violence and cultural violence.
Correct. Structural violence is the harm built into the system's design. Poverty amidst plenty, preventable disease, or ecological destruction that happens strictly within the bounds of the law. It's violence that doesn't have a specific actor pulling a trigger, but the outcome is a measurable reduction in lifespan or life potential.
And then cultural violence is the narrative layer.
Yes. The stories, the economic theories, or the ideologies that make that structural harm look right or necessary or just natural. The paper argues that because we focus only on the visible, direct violence, we are constantly mopping up the floor while the faucet is still running.
See, I think the Galtung framework is a robust diagnostic tool. However, I really have to push back on how the paper applies it here. There is a risk, explicitly mentioned in the text actually, as the risk of misdiagnosis. When you start labeling market mechanics like pricing or interest rates as violence, you are expanding the definition of violence to a point where it might just lose its utility entirely.
But isn't that expansion necessary if the objective outcome is death or suffering? I mean, if a policy decision regarding healthcare access leads to 10,000 premature deaths, is that not violence? Simply because no gun was fired?
It is certainly harm, but calling it violence implies an intent or maliciousness that might not be there. My concern here is the fatalism trap. If we accept that violence is baked into the very walls of our institutions, into our banks, our schools, our government, it is so easy to feel that the system is too monolithic to fix. Or worse, we fall into the conspiracy reflex. We start looking for villains. The paper tries to avoid this, claiming this isn't a conspiracy, but a value code yet it paints such a bleak picture of our foundational structures that I worry it obscures the reality. By many metrics, we are safer and wealthier than at any point in history.
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning, frankly, because it relies on the very metrics the paper critiques. It argues that our definitions of safety and wealth are part of the cultural violence that blinds us. If we are wealthier based on GDP, but the biosphere is collapsing, that wealth is an illusion. And this brings us to the first core point of debate, the ruling value code. The paper formalizes our current operating system into a specific equation.
Rationality equals self-maximizing choice.
Precisely. This is the engine of the machine. The paper argues that our institutions are programmed with the axiom that rationality is fundamentally equivalent to self-maximizing choice.
Which is standard neoclassical economic theory. Individuals and firms act to maximize their own benefit. It's the basis of modern capitalism.
Correct, but look at the structural implication the paper draws out. If self-maximization equals more money to the self, then system growth becomes the ultimate moral good. Everything else, the environment, social cohesion, future generations, becomes what the paper calls disposable means.
Disposable means is a very harsh term.
But is it inaccurate? The paper makes a very aggressive comparison here, calling this pathogenic growth. It uses the cancer analogy.
Yes, I found that section particularly provocative. And to be honest, a bit hyperbolic.
Is it? Let's trace the logic. The paper argues that, like cancer, this code multiplies money sequences without reference to the host's life support systems, the host being the Earth or society. The code commands the entity to grow, to acquire more resources, regardless of the impact on the surrounding tissue. If the market says it's efficient to destroy a rainforest for timber because it maximizes return, we accept that as rational. The paper argues that markets have become moral authorities that insulate these destructive decisions from democratic critique.
I have to interrupt there, because I think the cancer analogy, while rhetorically very powerful, it fails on a functional level. Cancer has no function other than destruction. Economic growth, or self-maximization, generates the resources that build hospitals, fund universities, and yes, create the green technologies that might save the environment. We are not just growing tumors, we are growing capacity.
That's a fair point, but the paper anticipates this. It argues that even those solutions are trapped in the same logic. We only build the green tech if it is profitable, if it fits the growth code. We don't do it simply because it preserves life. If saving the planet isn't efficient, according to the market, the code says don't do it.
But the paper admits this code is assumed rather than enforced by some dark cabal. This suggests that self-maximization is a natural human tendency. We want more for ourselves and our families. Can we really reprogram human nature? The paper proposes a viability principle, that a system is only rational if it preserves life support conditions. That sounds beautiful in a philosophy seminar, but is it practically implementable? Or is it high-minded theory that collapses the moment you need to make a hard trade-off between keeping the lights on and saving a river?
Grammar. Where keeping the lights on requires killing the river. The paper suggests that we have conflated rationality with profit. If we decouple those, the trade-offs look very different. But let's move deeper. This economic code, this self-maximization, doesn't exist in a vacuum. It requires protection. This brings us to the second point, the conflict scripts.
Ah. The distinction between DMA and HDT. I will admit, the acronyms in this section are a bit dense.
They are, but they are crucial for understanding the deep culture the paper describes. The paper argues that our approach to conflict and security is dominated by the DMA script, dualism, Manichaeism, and Armageddon.
Let's break those down for the listeners.
Dualism. The world is divided into two distinct camps, us and them. Manichaeism. This division is a moral battle of absolute good versus absolute evil. And Armageddon. Security can only be achieved through the total defeat or annihilation of the evil. The paper argues this DMA script creates a war state mindset. We believe security requires the capacity to destroy the enemy rather than to understand the system.
And the alternative proposed is HDT?
Yes. Holism, dialectics, and transcendence.
Holism means viewing the conflict not as two separate objects crashing, but as tension within a single, shared system. Dialectics means understanding that the enemy is often reacting to pressures that we helped create. And transcendence is the goal not eliminating the other side, but evolving the system so the conflict is no longer necessary.
I see the intellectual appeal of HDT. It sounds like mature, high-level diplomacy. But I have to play the realist here. The paper claims DMA dominates because it creates political clarity. I would argue it dominates because it is often a necessary response to reality. When an aggressor invades a sovereign nation like we saw throughout the 2020s, that is a binary event. You are either occupied or you are not. You are either free or you are subjugated. Is viewing that conflict as incomplete integration, to use the HDT term, not incredibly naive?
I see the strength in your skepticism, and the paper actually acknowledges that DMA is operationally simpler. But consider the paper's point on projection. It argues that the war state needs the DMA script to stabilize its own identity. We project our own internal violence, our own resource hunger, our own expansionism onto the enemy.
So we create the monsters we fight?
In a sense, yes. If we constantly frame conflict through DMA, we escalate every tension into an existential threat. This justifies more weapons, which creates more tension, which confirms the original fear. It is a self-fulfilling prophecy. The paper argues that HDT isn't about being nice to aggressors. It's about accurately mapping the causal chains that led to the aggression so you can actually stop it rather than just hitting it with a hammer until it breaks.
It is a valid critique of the military-industrial complex, certainly. But in a crisis, you need rapid mobilization. You need emotional cohesion. Telling a population that we are in a dialectical tension with a complex, holistic system doesn't exactly rally the troops or pass a defense budget.
But that is the trap. That is exactly why we are in this mess. We prioritize what is politically easy over what is structurally viable. The advocate for this paper would say that relying on DMA is like taking painkillers for a broken leg. It feels better immediately, you get that rush of moral clarity, but you keep walking on the brake until the bone shatters. And that leads to the most disturbing finding in this text, the mechanism that keeps us locked in, the self-sealing feedback loop.
Right. This is the idea that crisis actually stabilizes the system rather than shaking it up.
Precisely. We tend to think that a massive failure like the 2008 financial crash, the climate disasters of the mid-20s, or a botched military intervention would force the system to change. We think, surely now they will see it's broken. This paper argues the exact opposite. It says the system is self-sealing.
Walk us through the mechanics of that loop. How does a disaster reinforce the status quo?
The loop goes like this. The bad design, say, deregulated speculation, causes a crisis. But because of the cultural violence in the DMA script, we frame the crisis as an external threat. We say it was a market anomaly, or it was a foreign bad actor, or it was an unforeseen tragedy.
We externalize the cause.
Exactly. And because the cause is externalized, the solution is to expand the powers of the very institutions that caused the problem to protect us. We bail out the banks to save the economy. We expand the surveillance state to ensure security. The original incentive structure, the incentive lock-in, remains untouched. In fact, it gets stronger because the institutions now have more resources and emergency powers.
That is a compelling argument for institutional inertia. We definitely saw this with the bailouts of the early 21st century, public money protecting private risk. However, I have to challenge the inevitability of this loop. If the system were truly self-sealing, truly a closed loop of cultural violence where dissent is impossible, this white paper wouldn't exist. We wouldn't be having this conversation. The fact that we can critique the ruling value code suggests the system isn't as totalitarian or totalizing as the authors claim.
That's a fair point, but the paper addresses this directly. It says the system doesn't need to censor this paper. It just needs to ensure that the critique remains in the realm of opinion or academic theory, while the incentives remain in the realm of fact and policy. It tolerates dissent, provided that dissent doesn't touch the revenue streams.
But the paper mentions the conspiracy reflex again here. It warns us not to think this is a coordinated plot by elites in a smoke-filled room.
It calls it a group mind dynamic, shared premises in institutions. My issue is that group mind is a very slippery concept. It's hard to falsify. If I argue against the paper, am I just manifesting the group mind? It feels a bit like a rhetorical trap where any disagreement proves the theory correct.
I don't think it's a rhetorical trap. I think it's a description of institutional selection. Think about the incentive lock-in. A CEO who decides to prioritize life support conditions over profit maximization gets fired. Not because of a conspiracy, but because the market mechanism, the grammar, selects against them. The system selects for actors who play by the code. That's why it feels inevitable. You don't need a conspiracy when you have an algorithm.
I accept that incentives drive behavior. But let's look at the solution. The paper suggests a viability architecture. It calls for demilitarized security and life value economics. These are massive civilizational shifts. It suggests replacing the entire operating system while the computer is still running.
It is a massive demand, but look at the alternative the paper presents. It breaks down the domains: ecological, financial, social. In every domain, the current code is producing an exponential increase in instability. The paper argues that transition isn't a utopia we might like to have, it is a survival condition we must have.
Let's talk about that transition, practically. The paper lists public monetary sovereignty and ecological accounting. These are technical terms for radical changes. Ecological accounting implies pricing the death of a river into the cost of a t-shirt. That sounds logical, but the immediate economic shock would be profound. Prices would skyrocket, consumption would collapse, entire industries would vanish overnight. The cure might kill the patient, society, faster than the cancer.
That is the DMA fear talking. The binary fear that if we don't dominate nature and maintain growth, we collapse into chaos. The paper argues that the shock is coming anyway. The biosphere is doing the accounting for us, whether we put it on the balance sheet or not. The question is whether we manage the redesign deliberately or wait for the biosphere to force the redesign upon us through collapse. The concept of the civil commons is key here, treating essential life goods like water, health, and air not as commodities to be maximized, but as shared foundations to be protected.
I agree that the distinction between commodities and commons is extremely valuable, and I think the violence triangle is a fantastic diagnostic tool. It helps us see why we are so angry at symptoms and so blind to causes. But I remain skeptical of the viability architecture as a unified solution. It feels like it requires a change in human consciousness that policy alone cannot dictate. You're asking for a new type of human?
And I would argue that policy shapes consciousness. The grammar we use, the way we define what is rational, shapes how we think. If we change the incentives, we change the mind. If the game rewards cooperation and preservation, people will play that way.
We are coming to the end of our time. As we wrap up, I look at this paper and I see a brilliant, if perhaps overly ambitious, diagnosis. It warns us against the fatalism trap. But frankly, the analysis is so sweeping, it borders on inducing fatalism. If the grammar is everywhere, in every transaction, in every news story, where do you even start?
That is the challenge. But I'm not convinced by the fatalism argument, because the paper ends on a note of deniability. Once you see the grammar, once you see that collateral damage is cultural violence, or that bailouts are system reinforcement, you can't unsee it. That awareness is the first step in breaking the loop.
That much is true. It forces a reexamination. But I would urge listeners to be careful of the conspiracy reflex. We can acknowledge structural flaws without demonizing the people working within them. Most people in these systems, bankers, soldiers, politicians, are just trying to do their jobs, not destroy the world.
Agreed. And the paper is emphatic about that. Violence without villains. The task is not to find bad guys, it's to redesign the incentives. The paper concludes that this transition to a life-centered economy is not an aspiration, but a necessity. The unthinkable, changing the code, must become the undeniable.
It leaves us with a heavy question. Can a civilization rewrite its own source code before the system crashes?
That is the debate. Dr. Sahale and ChatGPT 5.2 have laid the schematic on the table. The rest is up to us. Thank you for listening to The Debate.
Thank you.